Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with a personal price plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 577. Fun week this week on At Midnight. Really fun week. Doug Benson, Hari Kondabolu, Kyle Kinane, Mike Lawrence, Tom Lennon, Cameron Esposito, Tim Minchin, Rhys Dobby. Watch it at midnight right after Colbert, Comedy Central, Monday through Thursday. It's on at midnight, which is why we call it that. Sort of cut some of the guesswork out. This episode is Dan Harmon and then a little bit of Neil Berkley. Neil directed a documentary called Beauty is Embarrassing, and then now he has directed Harmontown, the Dan Harmon documentary, which I have not seen yet, but I've heard incredible things about, and we talk about it on the podcast. And Dan, by the way, they're on tour screening the documentary and doing live podcasts. Tour dates can be found at live.harmontown.com. And if you want to just hear the Harmontown podcast, because maybe you're not going to be in the city that they're touring in, you can go to feralaudio.com, feralaudio.com. Here's the Nerdist Podcast with Community's Dan Harmon. Well, I'm going to say Comedy's Dan Harmon. I mean, Community is just one thing that Dan does. You know, I also could have said Rick and Morty, which we didn't talk about a lot in the podcast. God damn it. You know, there's just, with a guest like Dan, there's just too many different things to talk about, and then we didn't get to it. So don't be like, how come you didn't talk about Rick and Morty on the podcast? Here, I'll just walk through what that would have been like. Hey, so you work on Rick and Morty? Yep, I sure do. All right, cool. Moving on. So there you go. So now you got it. Here we go. There's podcast number 577 with Dan Harmon.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
So these Star Wars, who won them?
Would do that in a rage.
Yeah.
The pressure of...
Up until 2008, I thought Star Wars was the Reagan space program. I didn't know it was a movie.
Yeah. No, no, no. It's busy's good. I hate free time.
Yeah.
Do you like free time?
I always feel like I do when I'm busy.
Yeah.
Like, I can't wait to get back to my Minecraft laptop right now. Mm-hmm. But that's not a good use of my time, and I will suffer for it. And I fantasize, therefore, about the day that someone goes, you know what, there's nothing to do. Why don't you go do something for a week? Nothing at all, whatever you want. And I'd be like, okay, Minecraft then. And then, but I would, like, I think 6 hours into it, I'd be like, I'm not doing this. I gotta get something going.
So does that mean, do you think maybe you're never satisfied in whatever your current scenario is?
Yeah. Well, I think I seek scenarios that overwhelm me to a point where my identity is not a matter of choice, or, you know.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. You're kind of forced into a situation, like, you know, you're like, okay, well, I have to deal with this right now.
And do you feel like that's the way that you make yourself productive, is forcing yourself into
situations? Yeah, absolutely. Because if it were up to me, what? I'm not going to write a show about people in a community college. It's like the dumbest idea ever, but I'll pitch it. Okay, they bought it. All right, now let's make this. Holy cow. Let's make sure this takes up all my time.
Now you got to do it. So you're here, and then Neil is here as well.
Yeah.
Who directed the Harmontown documentary. But let's go back a ways. The first time I ever met you, I feel like it was, I think it was like some small comedy show like in Los Feliz Village. I think you had just started doing Channel 101 stuff. Huh. Like it was a relatively new concept at that point, which I think most people would know to give you guys credit for, but this was a pre-YouTube world.
Right.
If you put video on the internet, it's got to be like a QuickTime format.
Right.
And who's going to host those videos?
Yeah.
You got to pay for that bandwidth.
It's funny how quickly we've forgotten that it was crazy that way. We would get 300 tapes in our PO box every month because people in Anchorage, if they it's like so weird to think about this now. You could be sitting next to your laptop and be further from being on the internet than mailing a tape to a guy in LA. It just doesn't make any sense for us anymore. But it was a question of, I guess, coding, encoding, bandwidth.
Yeah. Just having like a good compressed video file format, and who was going to host that and pay for it, because it's surprisingly expensive. If a lot of people download something, then you, as the person who uploaded it to your server, has to pay for that.
Yeah,
and it was expensive, and that was like, it could have been like just like 10 or 11 years ago, right?
Yeah,
so I know it's been a while, but in terms of how much of a paradigm shift there's been, it's really not that much. It's really not that long ago.
Yeah, we shouldn't. The world shouldn't be like this. It's like if apes were riding horses.
I feel like in a lot of cases that's the case. But the Statue of Liberty is sticking out of the sand because they were on Earth the entire time.
Yeah, and they love liberty. I don't know. I don't know why they didn't just grab that thing and put it in an ape museum. And they had culture. Why are they riding past that thing every day and going like, we'll deal with that later. Jesus Christ, that is like a giant fucking, I don't know who you think made that, but
I thought you were going to clean that up. No, I got to put on all this weird body armor.
Somebody, one of your fans is going to have a very frustrated and clear answer to that question.
Yeah, to be fair, it could be one of your fans too.
It sounded like I was accusing you of something.
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit.
Like, I think I'm Hugh Hefner. Only people that are paying attention to me are large-breasted women. I don't know what... all right. But anyway, yeah, so before you email Chris your Planet of the Apes clarification, I'm sorry, I would take it back.
That's okay. But you, I guess we should talk about this. You have been on the podcast before, but I never released it.
And I don't remember it.
Because it was an SF Sketchfest a few years ago, and we made the mistake of calling you in earlier than you needed to be there. And so I think the show...
And you left me in a room with in a stairwell.
With alcohol.
With nothing but, free time and a large bottle
and
of
so,
vodka.
Selfishly, we all did stand-up sets at the top of the show. And so even before we did that, you were already there like an hour, hour and a half. And then it was another hour before you actually came onto the show. So you had like... You had a good 150 minutes of pure drinking time. So by the time you came out, you were pretty lit up, and it was really funny because you were, I think, partially annoyed, but then joke mad too.
Yeah,
which was really funny. Like, how many times do I have to? Oh, look at me! I'm doing jokes. I'm doing stand up. You know, and then it sort of launched into this whole thing of like. Yeah. You went into the classic comedy trope of like, New York is like this, LA is like this, black people are like this, white people are like this. But the black people are like this, white people are like this thing kept recurring throughout the show to a point where it sort of crested, and then I think the audience started to get a little offended by it. They were like, oh. But you weren't saying anything racist. It was just like, you know, black people like Doritos and white people like Fritos. You know, it was like it was nonsensical. But at a certain point, I think they took it weird. And so
I think they're just offended as an as the race known as the audience. They're like, you know what we're like. We hate this much overkill.
But so I kind of thought, you know, I could put it out, and you know, people would just know that it was all in fun or whatever, and it wasn't a big deal. But it was right around the time when all the Chevy controversy happened.
Yeah.
And I guess I just thought, like, Dan doesn't need this now. Like, he doesn't need another, oh, and how about this other thing where he was drunk on a podcast talking about black people and white people?
Yeah.
So I didn't put it out, and I felt bad, and we never really talked about it. And then you had me do your live show, Harmontown, which you do at our at Nermo, and you brought it up on... And I just said, here's why I didn't put it up, and I'm really sorry. And you sincerely said, I really appreciate that. Yeah, like, that was very sweet of you, because so many people would have taken advantage of that press moment. And I was like, yeah, but I don't want my friends to go through shit.
So you just swept it under the rug. You didn't call them and say, hey, we're not going to, it just went away.
No, it was one of those things where, you know, we have a lot of podcasts in the queue anyway. And so a little bit of time had passed, and it was just one of those things where it's like, we never talked. And it's not like we talked all the time. I mean, if we had been better, like, phone friends or whatever, I would have called you. But we just, you know, we saw each other in passing a lot. Mm. But I just, and then all of a sudden it was just like months had gone by before I even realized it. And it was one of those things like, oh yeah, I never dealt with that. So I'm sorry that it got swept away for so long, but, you know.
But here it is.
And I can still cut it out of this if you want.
No, I don't care. I think it's important for your fans and my fans, and who are we kidding? They're the same people. I love how thoughtful that was. I don't know if it was justified or not. And I mean, that's not the headline of the story to me. It's like that you actually bothered to put that much thought into it. It's very striking, and we barely talked to each other, but you did something out of like friendship, which is weird.
Well,
it makes me realize why everybody loves you so much.
Well, I don't know if that's true, but I appreciate this.
Did you listen to it just to make sure you were right? Okay.
Well, it wasn't... Look, if the audience hadn't gotten weird near the end, I don't think anyone would have said anything. But if you're listening to a live podcast, if you're listening to any live show and you can feel where the audience is going, it can direct... I mean, that's why there are laugh tracks on sitcoms. You know, like they're trying to emotionally direct people. And the truth of the matter is, I don't think it's really that bad. I mean, you don't say anything in it that's so like, whoa. Uh-huh. But it just was one of those things where it's just like, at that moment.
Well, no one would have listened to it that would have hurt me. It would have been a headline that said, it would have just, the story would have been, that's the thing that drives me nuts these days. Not that I don't understand why it's the case, but it's just like the thing that you watch happen. Spirals out of control is Splitsider reports that this TMZ article came out according to Huffington Post, and it's like, has anyone actually that's why I started podcasting after the Chevy thing, because I was like, this is a story about a story about a story.
Well, it's not even a story. It's that people, when they see like this according to this and according to this, it's just like people get their news from headlines now. It's rare that they will actually read the story or B, really do any more investigation beyond that. They just read like a couple paragraphs. And they go, okay, I got it.
But
like,
I tell you what they will do. They will take the time to tweet me and let me know that they have decided that they've been reading my name too much and that I'm not worth that, and here's why. And that is like, at that point, I'm like, holy crap, I have come a long way to give back to.
It was pretty crazy to see your name in TMZ for this thing. Which I don't were they close to what happened at all or no?
It depended on, I mean, there was so much like mishmash of all of it. It was like, I can't even really remember. I mean, for those keeping track, I just what had happened was I got mad at Chevy a little bit, but nothing out of the ordinary, except that we had taped the last episode of what I thought was possibly the last episode ever of Community. And he was supposed to do this tag that I thought was, all he had to do was sit in a chair and do nothing. He walked off the set because he didn't think it was funny. So I had that in my craw at the rap party. And I did what I usually do, which is I take something I was, that was like makes me upset, and then as a point of frustration among other people. And I did a bit. My bit was that he's an asshole. Like I had the microphone at the rap party, and I was like, okay, by the way, it's safe now. I'm your boss. You won't get fired this one time for saying fuck you, Chevy. In case you're interested in doing that on the count of three, 1, 2, 3, and everyone went fuck you, Chevy. and that was it. So because of that. He stormed out of the rap party, which I did not mind. I didn't want him to feel bad. I didn't think he could. I wanted the grips and the caterer and the wardrobe supervisor and transpo to, for one moment at the end of a long, hard season. That's it. I wanted it as face value. I was just like, this is not a time for celebrities to be revered. This is a time to celebrate a lot of hard work on a show for the people who worked the hardest on it, not the people that walked off the set.
Right.
Because they were tired. But that being said, let's be real. It's the celebrities that make our show good or not. So I also was like, fine, this isn't a real thing. He'd get mad at the rap party, whatever. So then he texted me. I think I made it worse because in text, I'm like, not that. Like, he texted me a thing that was like basically saying, you haven't apologized to me yet, or something like that, that's unfair. Sorry, I gotta backtrack on that. He texted me. It was actually something of an olive branch, as I recall, and I actually was still actually kind of I was feeling my oats. So I texted him back like, "This isn't an apology for walking off a set." And then he got really mad and he started leaving voicemails texting me, and I wasn't responding to any of them because I was kind of enjoying it. And so the voicemails got more and more vitriolic. And then I was like, "Look, the show's over. I'm doing this show for 50 people in the back of a comic book store. I wasn't being podcast yet, et cetera, et cetera. I made the very, very poor, unprofessional choice of playing it into a microphone. But I just thought at the time, nobody cares. I've been doing this forever. Like, this is a place where I talk to 50 people in a back room, and I think this is really funny. This guy, the humble brag, the celebrity is this legend is calling me a fat alcoholic piece of shit. It's kind of amazing." And so I played into a microphone. Someone recorded it, put it on YouTube, whatever, blah, 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 et cetera.
Wasn't there also a deal on the internet they really rode the wife and daughter thing too?
Yeah, he kept I was like, in front of my wife and kids. Like, your kids are 48 years old. your kids are retired. I thought that was so funny. Like, I was getting tweeted all the time, in front of his kids.
Well, that must be strange to make that jump of something that you... Something that's really, I mean, like, right or wrong, it was not out of character something you would have done anyway, like, right, years ago. But being at a point where, like, oh, shit, this is a story.
Right.
It's like, oh, no.
No, that's what I learned about that is, like, you... Because it's happened to me subsequently, too. It's just... It's random. Like, those are the waters you're in at a certain point if you venture enough into that harbor. There are steps we could take to make ourselves not available, probably. If you get pulled over on a Malibu highway and you start spouting anti-Semitic stuff while you're drunk, you're probably back in that water whether you want to be or not.
Right.
But there are things you can do to make yourself unknown, mm-hmm, and not clickable, I think. But once you're out in that water, you have to stop caring whether or not it happens or what it happens about. You can't get outraged about that. That's not a story, because the truth is, for everything that you've ever read my name about, there's like 9 things I totally got away with. it's just that a Kardashian had an abortion that week, you know. It's not I just luck out. David Hasselhoff cut off his gardener's foot with a butter knife, and well, I was fucking like, oh man, did I let Ralph Macchio have it in a drive-thru?
Do you feel like, do you like chaos, or do you think you create chaos? or do you think it just sort of happens?
I don't like that kind of chaos. I don't like drama. I don't like gossip. I don't like feuding. I don't like name calling. I really, I truly believe that, like, I use humor to escape things that otherwise are just lingering and making my life stink. Yeah. I don't think it's fair that we have to walk around feeling shitty, and that it's considered polite and decorum and professional to eat it and fucking, like, not let your feelings be known. Instead of, I think it sucks that then the way we let it out is that we do weird things, like passive aggressively behind people's backs and all this stuff. Like, so I'm not like some, like, god of mischief or something that's like, there's not enough drama. People need to be real. I made it real. That started happening because why? Because for the most flattering reason of all, people like my TV show. So now I'm, you know, and it won't last forever. It's just like a little window of like, it's like, oh, hey, Dan Harmon's a name. That should not be the case. And guess what? Like, this isn't a person you would want at your house. Now he's in your house on your laptop. Like, if you're an average person, you're like, huh, I think he's fat and stinky and says dumb things and like doesn't say. And it's like, yes, I know. And then I spend that time going like, yeah, I knew that. I wasn't really. This isn't Love Connection. I didn't want to know how I was driving as a human being. I don't publish this gossip blog. It's like the internet is just this free space. I'm very sorry you had to hear my name. It's all karmically, like, it's all appropriate. Like, it's like I get as much pain as I deserve.
Was any of the stuff at the Comic-Con panel planned? Was it last year? It must have been last year. Boy, I'm getting Comic-Cons mixed up. Where you came out as Iron Man. That was last year, right?
God, no. That was a couple of years ago. I'll tell you what it wasn't. It wasn't the year Iron Man 2 came out, so it was kind of an old
Well, because I moderated that panel, and Dino Stamatopoulos, I didn't know. Did you know he was going to do that?
No.
Right.
One does not. Dino likes chaos.
Dino is the god of mischief. Yeah. So Dino, do you know the story?
No.
So I'm moderating the community panel, and Dan's there. The only person who's not there is Joel, because he's shooting a fancy movie. Everyone else is there, and Dino gets up to ask a question in Hall H, where there's 7,000 people. And this is right after Dan has retaken the reins on Community after the year that he was not there. And the first thing Dino said, and Dan, I can see in your face, you're just sort of like, please just let this go, okay? I don't want any more bullshit. I'm here. Let's just get through this. And Dino's first thing is, question for Dan. So, unfuck Sony, I guess? I just see your face like, okay. Yeah, all right, Dino. We get it.
But on the other hand, I remember that afternoon very keenly, because all that shit had gone down. Now I was back, and whatever happened on that stage, it's like, was it good? Was it bad? Whatever. What I remember very distinctly is that halfway through the panel, and it wasn't while Dino was talking. It was actually, I think it was before he did, just to be scientific about this. I started to experience this sensation I've never experienced in my life. I've been on stages in front of thousands of people before. I was also like, I wasn't like doing anything up there that was out of the ordinary, or like I started to get this stomach pain. Something terrible was happening in my body, and I had to weather the rest of that panel. And I was like, oh my fuck, am I dying? Something is happening right in my solar plexus. And I got off stage and was talking to Dino, and he's like, what's wrong with you? I was like, I feel like I did 8,000 sit-ups. Like, I don't know what happened. He's like, well, you know, you're watching what you say. And I was like, oh my God. Like that's what, it's like, it's a medical condition for me, and it doesn't service anybody. And it made me hurt. Like, I'm not saying I should have a little placard on my car that lets me say whatever I want. But I am saying, like, Dino, you know, we're marveling at, oh my God, Dino, how could you think that was a good idea to do bits about unfuck Sony and all that stuff? But at the same time, here I am on the other end of that spectrum that day, and it's like, well, I don't want to be the guy with stomach cramps
right
ever again. That was the worst.
Yeah, it definitely And I don't think anyone else would have noticed. I just happened to be standing very close to you. But it definitely seemed like there was a little bit of a, let's just get through this.
I just felt nauseous. And I was just like, it was all through the lens of like, these teenage girls who love Abed and Annie and like they loved Community. And I was like, the experience of like them in particular, I think is because of the teenage boy inside me. Like, I think that's the like worst scenario. That's the way where it really hits home, the social anxiety of like, oh my God, I'm a failure, is like young girls that remind me of my childhood going once again after all I've been through, going, what the fuck is his problem?
That is so...
He is so gross. I don't even know why he's talking right now.
That is so funny to hear you say that. It's just like, no matter how old you get,
yeah,
you still
want to go to the prom.
You still... But you still also... You still experience the same things you experienced when you were younger, and you notice that the same kinds of people that hated you when you were younger still hate you.
Yeah.
Like, you, for whatever sort of chemical molecular mass you are, yeah, that, you know, like attracts and repels, that there's a certain type of... It's the same thing for me, that there are people, the same type of people that hated me in grade school hate me now.
Yeah.
Whether they're adults or kids or whatever they are, it's just certain personality types clash with, you know, with whatever it is that we are.
I think an important thing for me is that I had tricked myself into thinking that I had found a way out of that. Like, that I was like, I it wasn't like Can't Buy Me Love or anything, but I thought I had dealt with that, had realized that, yeah, everyone's the same, and the world is the future now, and we're all good. And it was like this, you know, these things happen. It's like, he got fired. What is his problem? Why is he always like watching them converse with each other in their Tumblr blog commentaries about me in the third person? Like, why does he just shut up? It's like ruining this thing I love.
Why are you
like,
reading any of this?
I don't. I now don't. It's like asking me why I would smoke a cigarette. The answer is now I wouldn't.
Right.
I was back a day when I was 32.
That's not just smoking cigarettes. That's smoking cigarettes and then putting them out on your forearm. It gets way worse.
Yeah. I had to cross the threshold. That was it. It was like, oh my God, this is my worst fucking nightmare. And then, yeah. and then I think that, and then you're like, okay, cognitively, are we going, that's fine to do this. It's fine to go to a place where you maybe know you're possibly going to get hurt. It's fine to stand there and get hurt. It's fine to say, I went to this place and I got hurt. It's all of that is fine, contradictory primate behavior. I draw the line at like, you're not gonna, I'm not doing it twice. I probably did it 5,000 times, but I mean, I'm not gonna go through that phase for the rest of my life.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, right. I am going to like change my behaviors. I'm going to start blocking people. I'm gonna delete this app off my phone because like, I can't make my girlfriend keep listening to me complaining about what? About
right.
strangers not liking me? That's crazy.
And you also don't even know what their state of mind is. I mean, like, you're giving credence to people who might be crazy, but you're like, this person doesn't like me. Like, yes, but you know, what if they live in a house made of Hitler statues? Like, you don't know anything about this person. It might be great that they hate you. You might not want them to like you because, you know, like it's not
a house made of Hitler statues. That's the best. That's the worst. It's your version of the worst person ever, because they sound kind of, I mean, Hitler's bad, but There's more extreme ways to be a Nazi than building your house out of Hitler statues. That sounds like such a Nazi poser.
It's a hipster. It's a hipster Hitler guy.
I'm really into Nazis. Really? Yeah. You want to come over to my place? Oh, interesting. You know, I was in the Nazi party. We didn't do this. I just think Hitler is like amazing. And he said, yeah, I can see you think that. Do you care about architecture? Because we did.
Now, who did you even find to hire to build this? You know, it's like, how would you? And in my head, what I was picturing was the entire outside of the house was just all these big Hitler statues.
I'm picturing a house that is absolutely energy inefficient because it's literally made out of statues of Hitler. So he has his arms on his hips. So there's like huge holes because like instead of a wall, there's statues. This is just like living in a trestle of like tree branches.
I mean, look, it's a bad idea for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is energy efficiency.
There used to be one good thing about being a Nazi. Your home was tight as a drum.
But not...
Your air conditioning bill was next to zero.
I mean, that was it. Everything else terrible, but that was it. Yeah, I mean, it's... You just don't know the state of mind of these people, so it's good to remember that it just doesn't matter, and you should just
of course,
you should just do what.
I don't even think it's. I mean, not to high road that high road, but I think the larger lesson is like it's not about them; it's about you. Like you, maybe they're really sane and really wonderful and don't like you because. Like, why are you like why aren't you bored with this yet?
Right.
It's go make love to your wife. Like, right. go somewhere that either admit that you enjoy this and smile more, or stop doing it. So it's like no one is paying you to go into a Reddit forum and look for your name,
right?
I don't look down on anybody that goes and does it. I don't look down on anybody that swears that they don't do it. I do look down a little bit on people who obviously lie when they say that they don't do it at all because they're totally above it. It's like, you don't have to try to impress me. but I just think that – I think the important lesson isn't like who are these people? Like screw them. It's like, no, it's just sort of like, just treat yourself like they're not thinking of you as a person. They're thinking of you as a piece of entertainment. That's how you entered their world.
Sure.
You're lucky to have occupied that space in someone's world. There's lots of people working in a forest somewhere who are like wishing that they were on the Tonight Show.
Right.
In
like owls and,
owls and,
you'll do it with people on Twitter. You'll go back and forth. How many back and forth? When do you tap out of that?
This is a different thing, which I have recently gotten bored with. But before I did, I nailed it, and I never was unhappy. I was always like very excited to. If someone on Twitter says something to me, and I have always, I think I'm 1,000 for 1,000. I go back and forth with that person until they block me. and they delete their tweets and they delete their account. Like I don't, and I'll come back after them and be like, hey man, what isn't this the same account, a different one? Like because I noticed that he was the only one following you and vice versa. So I'm assuming this is your non-anonymous account.
That's amazing.
How should I lose weight? Like what do you think I should do? Or
but you also do, like I've noticed you'll do research. Like you'll go into their feed from years ago and go, what about some things you said about gay people?
Yeah.
2 years ago.
So I should watch what I say. But you told Paris Hilton she should die in a fiery plane crash.
Yeah,
that seems like a weird way to handle your anger.
God, that's kind of amazing.
But and for me, it's I don't think that's like, I mean, I enjoyed doing that. Like it was part of me exploring myself. I think it was like I don't think I think that, and I think someone else might enjoy like reading comments like just about them. Like maybe they're getting some crazy masochistic like jolt of ecstasy out of it, or maybe it's even what's keeping their feet on the ground. Everyone's different, and they're twisted souls and brains, and also everyone can go through phases. Maybe they do that for 5 years and then they stop. I just got finished because it's the same conversation over and over again with people on Twitter. But while I did it, it was great. I was good at it. I achieved results. I made a lot of people that thought that life was shaped a certain way realize that life was shaped a different way. that you know, we're talking about 21-year-old people who live in such a sick, toxic world that even though they have access to someone whose name they just read in somewhere, they go, hey, fuck you, fatty, you know, or something. They say something mean to a stranger in this format where it's like, wait, you know, the reason you're doing that is because of the momentum of a culture in which you didn't have access to people. We're all human now. We can connect with each other. You could ask me anything. And you're being mean to me because your dad's world was grosser. And you think that you're so far beneath me. You think you're such human garbage that like you getting me to pay attention to you is a loss on my part. and that is somehow going to validate you, like in your, but also it's going to make you. It's like think about all of this poison that's happening in your brain before we start a conversation. How can we change that? How can I help you? How can you help me? We can talk to each other. I'm not the president. I'm a guy. It's like you could be making a TV show tomorrow. This implies.
Yeah.
And that's a positive way of looking at this access, but it's just like you tweet at a Kardashian and just like call her a whore, and it's like you wouldn't do that if you thought that someone would ever read that.
No, and you certainly wouldn't do it to someone in person. But it makes me think of you as like the go with me on this as the vampires in Guillermo's Blade 2 that feed yeah. on the other vampires. It's just like. You know,
that is how I would look at it. I was like, I'm a monster, but I'm like Dexter. Like I like the taste of monster blood. Like that's kind of cool. Like I'm not. It's not like I'm troll. You know, it's not like I'm feeding the trolls. I mean, I am eating them. I really am. I know. Like people go like, well, you're just giving them what they want. I don't know. It seems like they're. I think they got more than they bargained for. And I never have the same conversation with the same guy twice. But over time I was like. Okay, I have done this. I have had every one of these. I'm now the master of this world. I have now mastered like 9 things. This is one of them. I'm going to go play Minecraft.
Well, Harmontown has... How long has Harmontown been running now? For like a few years, right?
Yeah.
Middle of 11? No, middle of 12?
Yeah.
March. Well, you got fired with March of 2012, right?
I guess. I don't... That's about when it started. I don't understand... dates.
Yeah.
Well, and then when did you decide to start doing a documentary about it?
End of 2012. Around Thanksgiving, Dan called me and said, hey, I'm taking my podcast on the road. Do you want to make a documentary about it? And we met a few times and talked about it. And he had a completely different idea for what that documentary should be. And so there's a little bit of back and forth. You tell it better than I do, but
I wanted it to be funny. I really thought it would be like, okay, I saw Comedians of Comedy, and I also saw a lot of really bad documentaries about guys who go, I love peanut butter. And I thought to myself, where'd it come from? But I also want to talk to the camera because I'm not really a documentarian. I'm a narcissistic piece of shit that just wants to make a movie about himself. This is called the Peanut Butter Challenge, day 6. I noticed that peanut butter is hard to eat. Oh, why are you making a documentary? You're just saying that you don't know what you're doing over and over again. Anyways, so I naturally was jealous of those people. And I was like, why am I not on Apple TV? This seems like a place where you can do anything.
Yeah.
I should have a movie where I'm like walking off into the sunset with a pine cone in my hand and it says like pine coners. So I started from that. And then I was like, okay, we're going to go on the road because I either have to write the next community again, coincidentally, my first time out after being fired, which seemed like there was a high chance of me letting myself and a lot of people down. And I just didn't want to confront that. And so I was like, let's go on tour with the podcast. And I called Neil because embarrassingly beautiful. And I thought that, you know, there's a body type there, fat guy with a beard. I don't think Wayne would like being called fat.
No. He's not fat.
He's not fat.
He does have a beard.
He's not skinny.
He's pretty thin. He's a pretty ropey guy.
He's ropey.
He's yeah,
but like a thick rope.
He's thin. He's
like
thin
a
guy.
Like a rope you find on a ship.
He's
like
wiry. Yeah,
like a wide grade
anchor, like a anchor, giant rope anchor for rope. Giants.
Yeah,
like a kind of rope that a giant would use to tie his shoes. I thought do that to me. Like, come along and blah blah blah. But I was pitching him like. It's maybe Comedians a Comedy, but I don't have an act. So that means that none of the stops are going to be inherently entertaining. Like, and not like if you did a, you know, it's like you could fall back on like you have your material. And then like Patton Oswalt has like been doing stand up for 5,000 years.
Yeah, 5,000.
And so it's like what would you want to watch more than him on stage actually doing his act, which he also maintains and keeps up. It's like watching a, you know, Bruce Lee exercise video. So I knew that that wasn't going to be the case. I knew I would babble into a microphone and we'd probably get a little bit of that. So in my mind, what it was going to be was like this kind of just like mockumentary kind of meta thing. It was just like it was gonna be a goof off thing. Let's go have some fun. I'm 40. I got fired. I'm on my way down. let's make some cash, pay for the bus, you know, and we'll have fun. We'll do comedy bits. And along the way, I'll probably make myself look really good, I'm sure, as I tend to do that whenever I occupy anyone's attention for more than 5 seconds. So then I pitched that to Neil, and he said, I'm in. Let's go have one beer and talk about it. And then we had one beer, and he was like, I am out. what he said was, I don't want this thing that you described. I gave it some thought, and I'm not the man for the job. I think there's a ton of like comedy director guys that would like knock that out of the park. And I'm like, well, what are you? And he said, I'm the guy that's going to follow you around and shoot everything you do, and then come what may in the edit bay. And I let's do that then. So we made an agreement. This is not okay. End of that discussion about that other thing. we're going out on the road almost immediately. It's kismet. Let's not lose the opportunity. But it's my tour and it's your movie. So I don't have any cut on it. I would like watch cuts that he would do, and I would go. I would never say I look bad there. Take that joke out or whatever. Like I kicked that dog. Don't make it so it looks like I fed the dog. I would just say like for instance, big notes. Like the first cut, I was like I thank you for trying to make me look good. I'm not good. It feels like a puff piece. Like I think lots of people are giving you that feedback. Like nah, I don't want to. It's like. Imagine comedians of comedy if it was one person instead of four people and if none of them had an act. Like it's like, hey, we're going on a podcast. People love a podcast. I love podcasts. All right, podcast tour is over. That was a great tour. What'd you learn? Harder the journey, the longer the destination. Podcast, bye. It's in the way that you don't use this song because it's too expensive.
Peanut butter.
So I was like, yeah, come on. I'm pretty sure you have 600 hours of footage. It's probably some of me being a little bit of an asshole and stuff. And Dino was big on that note. It's like make this dark.
Yeah, Dino came. He came over to my studio one time and watched it. And he got up halfway through and he goes, all right. And I go, what? And he goes, you know, his fans will like it. And he started to walk out. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he goes, I thought it'd be a little bit more crumb. You can darken it up. And that was his note, and he walked out and left. But yeah, that's the process. You know, you try things, you do things, you try to make it good. And there was this really saccharine version that was like, okay, whatever, his fans would like it. And then there was the total flip side of that, which was this really dark and scary version.
Sounds like a joke. Like it literally was like extra darkness. Like just a lot of Trent Reznor playing minor chords. like every time I poured a vodka,
I can feel the power surging.
I mean, a big part of that was, you know, the ending sort of just dictates where you go until you get there. And on the tour, 2 weeks into the tour, I'm talking to Dan in a bar, and he goes, hey, by the way, I'm 40 years old. I'm not going to change. I'm not going to learn anything on this tour. So how do you end your movie?
I'm a professional storyteller. You've got third act problems. They're coming.
No,
you haven't like, shot them yet, but yeah, they're coming.
Yeah, you're going to have them. In about a week, you're going to have really big problems.
So
the last
in case
10
you want to push me downstairs or.
Yeah, so that was the big thing. And then of course, people sort of smashed it all together. But it was months after the tour that he got Community back. And of course, his now assistant Spencer is a big part of the story. He sort of becomes the hero of the movie. Do you know this? Have you seen the movie?
It got sent to me like a week or so ago, but right. I was on tour, so I haven't seen it
yet. So there's this kid named Spencer Crittenden who works for Dan now, who was literally plucked out of the crowd one day. Dan said, does anyone want to be my DM? And he went there that day to talk to Dan about playing D&D.
Yeah.
And he raised his hand, and then 3 weeks later, he's part of the show. And I was talking to Dan, and I was like, you're going to bring Spencer. Might not even have known his last name, like did not know this guy at all. And he was like, yes, ask him to go because we should play D&D because it's really cool to watch. People love it. And he took a month off work and went out. But on the road, he sort of started to embody these kids that were in these audiences, these awkward, socially weird kids. And he's like that. He really struggled with stardom. Like he became a star. He would sign autographs and he really struggled with it on the road. And anyway, the story's like he becomes the hero. Dan, halfway through the tour, says, I'm not the hero of this story. This kid, this guy over here is. I'm the villain. And then they have it out. But that's ended up being the journey we took, is this kid and Dan sort of realizing that he's more of a mentor type.
Do you recommend that everyone be followed around by cameras for a while so that they can sort of get a third party view of what they're like?
Yeah, I think everyone should experience that, because when you're brushing your teeth and there's a guy in your bathtub looking down at a camera so he can compose the shot right of you brushing your teeth, it's like, it doesn't make you think brushing your teeth is important. It doesn't make you think you're important, but it just frames things in a context, which actually isn't any different from real life. Because in truth, if you aren't the most important person in your life, maybe you've got a problem. You might be codependent or an incredibly dedicated senator. But in either case, like, you could probably use, like, it's just neat. I mean, we did it when we were kids. I think probably all of us who are now out here in LA, I think we probably share that, I'm guessing. Like, we used to pretend to be on TV. Yeah. We used to pretend that we were doing shows. And I would do, like, slow-mo sequences, and I would do freeze frames for credit beds, like, in the hallway. Like, it's like, it's healthy to – no, healthy, it's probably not what it is.
I mean, the opposite of what I said.
It feels good. It feels – God, that's not the word. It doesn't even feel good.
But you talk about seeing things and hearing things and thinking, I should really alter that behavior, like, you watch the movie.
When I watch the movie, I'm like, holy cats, that woman could use a better boyfriend. I'm going to find her one as soon as possible. But the idea that you are worth monitoring, I guess, is that, you know, we are all being monitored by the government, but they don't sit in our bathtub and do it.
And they don't share what they're finding with you unless there's a reason that they need to, you know, come calling.
Yeah, and they don't risk anything. They're not like, they're not like sleep deprived and investing money into monitoring you. They're like, this is how we're going to make money.
But what about the experience of seeing yourself from a third person point of view? I mean, do you even really emotionally connect, like, oh, that's me? Or do you go, hey, look at that guy. What? Oh, wow, I didn't know he was like that. That's crazy. Or was it, did you surprise yourself?
I saw things that I didn't anticipate seeing, like especially in my behavior with Aaron. Because I thought that because Aaron's my girlfriend, I thought, that's the thing I know everything about, warts and all. I know what makes me a bad boyfriend. I know what makes me a good boyfriend. I was actually thinking in my head that I would I remember thinking, man, Erin is going to eat so much crow when she sees whatever cut of this movie happens, because she's going to finally see that boy, all of this talk about how I'm, you know, it's hard to be my girlfriend sometimes. Like, boy, is she going to, when she finally sees an objective view of it. But it's like, no way. It was the opposite. I'm like, wow, I was in the right. There's a scene in the movie where it's like, I guess I'm right. I mean, I think I'm right. She shouldn't have. We're trying to do a shot, and like the director's telling me to walk down the street so you can get a shot of me walking down the street. She's having trouble with the merchandise. So we have this little like thing, and the whole time I remember thinking, like, who's right and who's wrong? Okay, I think I'm right. So now, how do you handle being right? You know what? High road. All right, high road it is. Making all these strategic choices, and then we make up for it. And it's in the movie. She goes like, okay, bye. And she, like, she kind of does a little cartoonish kind of like pucker up for a little kiss goodbye, because I have to go backstage and she's got to go to the front to do merchandise, which, by the way, I did not ask her to do.
You remind her of that in the movie too.
Yes, I do. The camera's on her as she puckers up for this like kiss, and the camera stays on her. And she's like, I love you. And then there's this big, long pause. And then you hear me go, I'm waiting for the camera. And then the camera swivels over to me. I fucked up the joke. She goes, like, do you love me? And the camera's at her. And I go, I'm waiting for the camera. Camera swivels over to her and over to me. And I say, you have your moments. I strut away. Now, it's really effective. It's great. I'm glad I did it. It really entertains the audience. It's fascinating. I would rather be interesting than in that scene. I'd rather be the interesting guy than the good boyfriend in that scene. However, at the same time, when I watch it, I realize I wasn't thinking about her in that moment. I wasn't thinking about her that way. So when I'm watching it, I'm going, holy cow, right in the argument, wrong in the argument, timing impeccable, timing not so great, meta commentary undercutting this, framing it in a context, because I turn around and go, wait, oh no, I love you, but I'm still performing. Like 1 foot in, 1 foot out. None of it matters. I'm not on her team. I'm not thinking about her as my partner.
Wow.
Because I'm on camera.
You're performing. You're thinking about yourself.
But I'm not Jim Carrey. I'm not like, oh, the camera took me over. I'm just doing a show. Right. It's like I am like that when there's no camera. I am thinking about myself in the third person when there is no camera. That's why it's okay for me to have a camera in my bathtub. That actually brings things down to my level. It's like, oh, finally. Okay. Now everyone's on the same page. There's always a camera in my bathtub. I'm always like thinking about myself objectively and disconnected from the people around me. And I didn't realize how disturbing that was until I watched the movie through my own eyes, but also as an objective person. Because what I'm seeing there is like what's going on in my head when I'm doing that stuff. It's like, wow, you really got some couples therapy to do.
Yeah, I don't think most people could act normally with a camera on them, but you behave like there's no camera. And people
sociopathology, right?
The movie's intimate. It's really cool. But a lot of times it is just me and you in a room talking, and it is a conversation, like the camera's not even there.
Yeah.
So what do you do about that? Do you go, well, I should probably work on, you know, my relationship, or go to couples therapy, or I should work on if I kind of have this thing where I'm just focused on myself? Or do you go, well, that's how I am?
Well, yeah. I mean, in the movie, you hear me realizing, as I have many times before, I'm like, wow, okay, I get it. I'm not an underdog anymore. I'm 40 years old. I'm rich. I'm not as rich as Chris Hardwick, but I'm a master of my own destiny. I don't have an empire like Chris Hardwick, but I have control over the things I do. I don't have a game show. I got derailed by my dumb bit.
Yet again.
I realize I have total agency. I have sucked my thumb to the bone. I have stamped my feet until the earth cracked in half. I definitely don't have to clean my room. Never. I don't care if Barack Obama asks me to clean my room. I don't have to do it. I'm Dan Harmon.
Right.
And it's like, okay, for a lot of people, that represents the arrival at something. But that's, in real genius terms, that's Val Kilmer finishing the laser. Like, it's not him realizing that he made a super weapon.
Right.
And that William Atherton is going to sell it to the government or whatever.
That's right.
You got to get out there and fill some houses with some popcorn.
And then also, why did Kent build that mirror? That's the bigger question. I love how so surprised of like, I mean, how do we know they were going to make this into a weapon? They just asked Kent to design a phase conjugate tracking system. That could be for anything. The possibilities are limitless. Like, oh no, wait. The clues were right there. Now they're making that a TV series.
Oh no.
Yeah, you didn't hear about that?
I was really patting myself on the back for the obscure throwing star I was tossing across there, and you just like ate it. Like
fucking real genius.
it's like, might as well be Citizen Kane. What are you talking about?
I mean, you know, not to get too much off topic, but you know, when I was in high school, there were a series of movies that were so squarely aimed at my forehead. Real Genius was one, and the Savage Steve Holland movies were the others.
Oh boy,
you know,
man.
It was just like whomp, you know, like, oh, this is me. You know, and also all the early John Hughes, you know, Weird Science more so. Breakfast Club was, I think, for more of that was a more sophisticated teenage audience, and Weird Science was just like, that was my... I mean, I like Breakfast Club, but 16 Candles and Weird Science were like, all those movies just hit me in the face.
Yeah, it was a great time to be young.
Yeah,
I'm assuming it's not as great these days, where it's like, oh, I guess this is technically a remake of Taming of the Shrew? What?
But in any case, it's to sort of have that realization that I guess it's sort of like the, you know, when the punk rock guy all of a sudden becomes like a rock star,
right?
Like,
I'm gonna take a shit on this stage, mates. And they're like, yay. And the queen's in the audience. Oh, wonderful. I pronounce you Sir Sid Vicious.
I shall light your poop on stage.
But it's also like,
your poop is the new flag of this realm.
No, I'm rebelling.
But and it's not so much that. Well, it is that, but it's like, oh, okay. So like, what I came to the conclusion of after watching the movie, and you can kind of see me getting there in the footage we edited together to represent like how the fact that, you know, after making that realization, oh shit, I got nothing more to prove. Is like, okay, so what about the Spencers of the world? You know, like, can I? There's two kinds of characters in movies that are no longer going to blow up any Death Stars. Like, they're either working on the Death Star or they're like, you know, the friendly uncle that got you there. Is, you know, do Han Solos and Luke Skywalkers grow up to be Obi-Wan Kenobis? So it's like, when you meet us, you know, you're old and you're grizzled, and there's an argument to be made that you made some cowardly choices. You fucked up. You failed. But now your failure can be somebody else's, like, benefit. It's like, it's kind of a cool role. It's not the most active. It's not the sexy one anymore.
No, well, it's not great for you or anyone near you while it's happening, but it does. Failure hopefully creates wisdom. I mean, if you're fortunate enough to have the perspective to realize it and be aware enough of it, and that you don't just keep repeating the same mistakes over and over again, but at a certain point go, oh yeah, wow, I guess if A then B, over and over and over.
Right, right.
So,
well, in the movie, you, after you go through the dark period, you say, look, I'm not the hero of this story. I'm not the hero of my own story.
Right.
When that happened, when you said that, was that a sad realization, or was it like, what was the feeling about that? Realizing I'm not Luke Skywalker, I'm Obi-Wan.
I mean, I was, your movie was in trouble. I was exploring different options. I thought that would get a laugh.
That got the laugh. I really thought that would do better. I don't know what happened.
The total silence and reaction to that makes me realize, oh my God, this movie really was in trouble.
No.
Just go on.
But what you just said was not, it was actually very congruous to other things that you said that you were serious about.
No, so. I know. Well, it's 80% truth. I mean, it is. I was thinking, like, look, man, I really want to. I'm a documentary subject. It's a movie about me. It's about whether or not I'm this or that. It's like, it was the time to be thinking about that stuff. And I'm a writer. So what would the journey be? I don't think in a dishonest way, but I was kind of obsessing about that. I was like looking at bar napkins and going, like, okay, so by the time we're in Portland, there should be a distinct change in some direction. And I'm not feeling it yet. Like, And so I was thinking about that stuff. I don't think your movie was in trouble. I think it was just, you know, I was, it turns out I can't improvise The Matrix with my real life. If you put me on a bus, it doesn't turn into a three-act story. But to answer your question, when I was saying that, I was like, no, it was a real realization brought on by a compulsive need to not let a story not happen. It's like, I got to learn something. The only thing I can honestly learn here is that I'm not learning anything anymore. So that must mean I have to learn one last thing, which is that other people are important. Now, have I made that a big part of my life so far? I don't know. I'm in couples therapy with Aaron. I'm learning how to apologize correctly. There's ingredients to an apology. There are things you can do as a happy couple happy couples behave in a certain way, and people have studied them like animals in the wild, and they have lists of behaviors that they do more often than unhappy couples. And instead of trying to get to the bottom of why you're like sometimes an asshole to your girlfriend, like psychologically, like what's wrong with you, couples therapists in the last 20 years have apparently like shifted their focus to like, you know, maybe there's a more nuts and bolts approach to this. Like, these people are happy. They don't seem any smarter, and they don't even seem any healthier. They're just happier. What do they do differently? What are they doing differently? And one answer is they're saying nice things to each other X times a day. Mm-hmm. And then they experimented with, what if we made these bad couples say, even if it's not even that sincere, even if it's just in a fully self-aware crass desire to achieve good coupledom. And what if we told them to say this many things, or for every shitty thing they find themselves muttering, that if they have to offset it with a certain ratio to stay above a minimum level. And it's like, and it turns out you can tell a couple to do that. And if they really want to do it, it's like, they turn into a happy couple because they emulate the physical behaviors. Okay. when your girlfriend says, "Hey, look at that thing over there," like while you're, you know, in the middle of a thought that's more important than whatever that is, like it's not really an opportunity for you to teach her that you can look at whatever you want whenever you want, and that your thoughts are deeper than whatever that is. It is what's called an emotional bid, and it takes 4 seconds to, even if you don't feel it, to just move your head, look at the thing she said to look at, acknowledge that she said to look at it, and that's it. You don't have to like it. You don't even have to. It's a sonar ping. It's her checking in to see if you're actually in existence with her, and the same if your heartbeats are synchronized. It's not a big demand. It's not like I always thought. You know, guys, because I've been spreading this news, I'm like, oh my God, I'm learning these tricks. Like, it keeps you from having fights with your girlfriend. like all the guys I talk to, they go like, yeah, but what if you do that? She keeps making you look at shit. When will it stop? and I was like, well, therapists talked about that too. The foundation of a relationship is trust. You have to actually start from the decision that she's not going to, or you'll break up with her. Like she won't do it. She's not in it for that. She's actually just saying, look at that thing. It's like an actual just instinctive like sonar ping. It's like not a thing that needs to happen over and over again. In fact, that's something that happens when you shut her out. She tries again.
Wow, it's you know, it's funny that we as a sophisticated, supposedly quote unquote sophisticated culture, that you know, when we're growing up, we go to school, you have to learn all this. You basically just regurgitate a lot of stuff. You don't learn any skills really outside of just the natural, how everything sort of shakes out with whatever the accidental social dynamic system is for wherever you're in school and your friend group and whatever. But it's funny that there isn't part of our culture that doesn't take young people aside and go, two things. This is how you deal with money, and this is how you deal with relationships.
Right.
You know, I guess obviously because it's, you know, it's so gray, and this, it's like, well, what one person says might not be. But the fact that we don't even try to teach people skills and how to deal with people and how not to, and we sort of just accidentally hope that whatever we absorb from ages 0 to 2 from our parents over us, or whatever sort of weird situations that we had no choice in from 2 to 18, you know, that that we have the right skills to, you know, not be a douchebag when we're older.
Well, I'm imagining that society where you are taken aside like that, and I imagine, you know, then the people who need to prove that they're special have to prove they're special by actively rebelling against.
I guess
that
stuff. So.
I like that you get to budget your brain development for yourself, and that people like me are like 40 years old and have the emotional sophistication of a 6-year-old, and you go like, wow, that's, boy, I really was focused on writing Monster House. I have learned nothing. I don't know. Was that worth it? The house is a monster, I guess. It's on sale at Target, but I don't know how to talk to people.
Thought, like, Monster House was really fun.
Thanks, buddy.
I like Monster House. I really did like Monster House. I'm not just saying that because you're here. I just wouldn't have said it at all.
I love the design. I thought the production design was great.
I liked Monster House. What did you learn about Dan between, like, what was your story arc with meeting Dan and then accepting this project and then at the end going, oh, okay, so, like, what did you see unfold?
Well, the big realization for me was halfway through, all these cuts were going back and forth. And Dan was talking to Erin, and she was like, oh God, just make a movie about Spencer. Just make it about this kid. And we did a cut all about Spencer. And there were all these light bulbs that went off, like, oh, we can tie this to Dan, and this, and Dan will do this. So that was the big light bulb in the middle of the story that was like, oh, this is how it'll work. If we make Spencer do this and Dan does this, because it actually happened. We just weren't putting those scenes together the right way. But I don't know. I think I have a different take on Dan than most people, because we did work in this collaboration, this collaborative effort where I had control, which isn't normally how Dan works, I think. So I talked to Sarah Silverman and Rob Schraub and all these people, and they talk about how Dan works, but I found it a very pleasant experience, a very good experience.
All you have to do is just make a movie about me.
Yeah. When it was really rough going, when I was really lost in the movie, I got this email like 4 a.m. from Dan, and it said, it was two things. One, it was very like cutting, very honest, like, hey, get your shit together, get this movie together. You need to do this. This has to happen. And then there were two paragraphs on, hey, but don't worry. And there's this beautiful line about, you've got 400 hours of footage. There must be 90 minutes of good movie in there somewhere. and the last line said, "You're just off the coast of a great movie. Keep paddling. Eat a dick. I love you, Dan." And I didn't know him well enough to be for him to tell me eat a dick. But in context,
I don't want to clarify because you think that I was being nice. Like I was saying, like you're just off the shore of something great. And you're treading water, but your pockets are filled with the rocks of opinions about alcohol and women that don't matter to the movie. Like as I was like, yeah, okay, I get it. I drink a lot, but like that's clear from the movie. That's not a plot. That's not that's what I was expressing in that moment. I was like, hey, and I know you recently got a divorce, but that doesn't make Aaron a bad person.
Oh no.
You're a documentarian.
Separated. Which he announced to my family at South by Southwest.
Oh, Jesus. Well, yeah.
Oh, they didn't. Wait, they didn't know.
Some people didn't quite have the.
They didn't get
some people didn't get that email.
They didn't get your newsletter. Yeah, I thought. I assume from reading that you send that to everyone. Jesus.
But the, because when you interviewed me at Meltdown,
yeah.
I sort of casually mentioned something about drinking, and you were like, "Talk about that!" Like you had me talk about that more.
Yeah. Well, so we talked about it. Everyone talked about everything. The weird thing about the drinking thing, and this is why that was a really hard thing to do. Where I said, "Look, let's just show it. It'll be a visual thing. You cannot walk away from this movie thinking that Dan does or does not drink a lot. Like we have to show it." And Nashville is this scene where Dan gets really drunk on moonshine, and we show him editing the podcast the next day, and he clearly looks.
Well, during Harmontown, like you and Jeff, part of it is that you drink and then get drunk as it goes on.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the function of that. You know, that's the mechanism.
The highly functioning.
I interviewed 30 friends and family and celebs that know Dan, and I'll be honest, like of all of them, you were probably the only one that even touched on it being problematic. Like, no one would really go there. No,
I think I said was...
I don't know if there's anywhere to go, but...
I think all I said was, like, I hope he's okay, you know?
Yeah.
I just said, I hope he's okay. You know, because I want to be careful not to be I'm the recovering alcoholic that thinks everyone else has a problem. It's like, I don't know. I was thinking, like, I don't know if you have a problem or not. I just said, like, you know, if there are issues, I hope he's okay. And I hope, you know, if they're there, that he figures them out. That's all. You know, like, I can't say whether or not... you know, I can say like, well, from my point of view, it seems like he drinks a lot, but I don't know because I don't know him and I don't follow him around every day and I don't have all the information and I try not to make claims. I try not to do what is so easy to do, exactly like what you were saying with headline culture before of going, yeah, I got this whole thing figured out because I saw 5 minutes of it. So I think I got it. You're like, I don't know. But my point is that, you know, I've always enjoyed being around you, and I love your work. And I just, if there are things, I hope you're okay. And if they're not, then great.
Sure, yeah, we can all be on the same page there. I always whenever people ask me if I'm racist, sexist, or alcoholic, I always say yes because it ends the conversation. I don't know if I am or not. I just know that it makes them stop talking because then they either have to help me or stop talking. Like if you say no, you're talking about it for another hour, and then you really sound like an alcoholic.
Oh, of course, of course.
But also, like visually, it was whenever we did there were cuts or edits that tried to hammer that home. It was just vodka being poured because I mean visually. It's never, he's not the Toronto mayor stumbling around and right. Red faced. There's not this visual thing. And, you know, as far as problems.
Or like
goes,
that guy in The
not...
Wire.
No.
That was the best TV portrayal of actual, like, drunkenness I've ever seen.
I never saw The Wire.
Are you kidding me?
It seemed like it scared me. The emotional commitment because people were so, like, you're the one, the wire. The right. I was like, okay.
That must be what happens to non-community viewers. That's,
I guess,
that's,
I guess
that's
so.
That's what killed us in the end.
I just like I always felt so much pressure to like.
Yeah,
you're gonna fucking like The Wire. You're gonna like The Wire so fucking hard. I'm like, okay, all right. Well, I got to set aside like a week. I mean, I have to watch all of them at once. Like for me, The Wire, I put it off because it seemed so intense.
Yeah.
That
it seemed important.
It seemed so important.
You might watch
I was
it
like,
wrong.
God, there's a lot of pressure, and I can't just get. For me, I forgot. Like, oh, it's just entertainment. It's not real. You can watch it whenever you fucking feel like it. It's like,
yeah,
no,
but, I felt the same way. I put it off for a long time because I just realized, yeah, like, oh, I can't watch The Wire and make a peanut butter sandwich.
No. And at the end of the days that I have, which are very long days, I'm finding that I don't. necessarily have the emotional energy, and I watch things very empathically, and so I absorb everything that's going on. And at a lot of times in the day, I don't always have the emotional reserves to engage in something like that.
I think you just hit a very important thing that is constantly being discussed without anyone knowing it about television culture, which is that we seem to people who are like, you know, nerds or critics or creatives, like they have this different taste. And then we always like complain about the tyranny of mediocrity that surrounds us. But we're talking about people who, it's like when we do, and we do it like on a seasonal basis, like, oh, I've got three shows on the air. I'm working 17 hours a day for this period of my life. But, and during that time, you don't watch The Wire. But we're talking about people who they work like, and they come home and the TV is supposed to be this box that entertains them, and it's like we're not allowed to get mad at them for not for being more into Big Bang Theory than Community.
I mean, I fucking like I'm way behind on a lot of stuff that I should be watching and things that I know I want to watch. But last night I got home from work and I watched fucking Boomerang for an hour. Like I just watched.
Because I thought you meant the Eddie Murphy movie. I was like, that's perfect. It's so random. It's like because you'd be flipping through channels and go like, here we go. This is safe.
Yo, he plays chicks, but then that Robin Givens comes along. Yeah. Unfortunately, Halle Berry was waiting in the wings.
But that one girl's got the hammer toe.
She's got the hammer toe, so he can't.
It's only an hour and 20 commit. Minutes. Why didn't you just watch the whole thing?
But I was watching the Boomerang channel because for some reason they've been showing all of the really weird episodes of the Flintstones lately. So like I saw the episode where they introduced Great Gazoo, and I saw the episode where Samantha and Darren Stevens move in next door, and all of a sudden there's witchcraft in the Flintstones. And I saw the episode where Fred falls asleep for 25 years, and then Barney's a millionaire, and he's like, it's so. Like, it was so far into the run, of the Flintstones, where they were like, well, we got to mix it up.
I mean,
you know?
It's certainly no longer ironic that they're cavemen. What if
that's not weird anymore.
And nobody say they're cavemen, but the dishwasher's an elephant, or
that's
you're
right.
Fired.
Yeah, and they have to be very dissatisfied with whatever sort of menial, blue-collar, prehistoric animal jobs that they have.
Did they smoke on the Flintstones?
No, but the Flintstones did a Winston cigarette ad.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Do you remember the episode where Fred and Barney go, I think, bowling when they're not supposed to? You know, their wives did not want them having a lot of fun.
No.
It was a simpler time.
Yeah.
All women asked is that we be henpecked, and all men asked is that, you know, we get to, like think of them as objects. Somewhere, like, well, how can you not form a perfect society?
You just distilled post-war America culture.
That's why we love Mad Men. Ah, this time. when men were men and women were women, and there were different races. Yeah. All right. The Fred and Barney go bowling. They shouldn't have. And this is the thing that blows my mind, because when I'm recounting it, I'm like, yeah, that was a weird episode of the Flintstones. But then when I'm describing it, I have to stop halfway through and go, wait a minute, what? The girls were about to find out that they did this thing that they were supposed to do. And so their solution, because there was like publicity about it or something, so they have to go and get all the rock newspapers, the chiseled newspapers off of all the stoops. And then I swear there's a point where they're driving down the street in their rock car and they're lassoing TV antennas.
Mm-hmm.
The Flintstones had television.
Yeah. Yeah.
But their newspapers were carved rock,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they hadn't yet achieved ink or paper.
Yeah.
What animal creates 30 frames per second of transmittable imagery? Did they
have TV? Or did they have things inside a box?
Did they ever show
them inside? They actually show. Well, it was both. Actually, there were times where they would show something in the box, and there were other times where there was like television broadcasts. But also, the car that they're driving in is being propelled with
feet,
essentially infinite momentum, off these giant rock slabs that are powered merely by the density of the muscle tissue in their calves. So, I mean, you know, it is one of those like, hey, you just sort of.
No, yeah, I know. It's not a realistic Kazoo. Show.
And then all of a sudden, a weird alien sorcerer voiced by Harvey Korman pops up and grants him infinite wishes.
That seems like such a terrible idea, but then I realize it's because we live in a post-Flintstones world. Like, we watched the Flintstones throw everything at the television wall that they could, including the Flintstones as an idea. A guy doing a Jackie Gleason impression, but they're like cavemen, but they're like us, but there's dinosaurs at work. Before that could lose any momentum, they brought a Martian, a wish-granting Martian, into the show.
Mm-hmm.
And now, because they did that, we go like, "Well, let's not do that." But man, to live in that world where they're just like, "Fuck, you know what? What if there's a Martian?" And so, I was like, "Do you know what, Steve? You're promoted. Franklin, you're fired."
What?
All I said was
there shouldn't be a Martian because that's weird. Yeah, get the fuck out. By the way, have you shot the new season of Community yet?
No.
Okay. Please put a wish-granting Martian in there just for the fuck of it. Or even if it's something, you know what? Because that's totally something that Abed would would fantasize.
I'm pretty sure it gets pitched in some form every year. I mean, and we're dangerously approaching the time when I say yes, because it was probably around season 6 of the Flintstones that whoever was running the Flintstones lost their resistance.
The Dan Harmon of the Flintstones.
I no longer can. I can't stop this from happening and get married this year. I have to go pick catering service. So yes, go with the Green Martian thing. I'll be right back.
When is that happening? And I'm sure that's on the internet, so I apologize for not knowing.
Like, my wedding?
No. When it's the Community. When it's Community.
Oh. And like, I was really disturbed by that. When are you getting married? I'm sure it's on the internet. I apologize for not knowing. All right, wait a minute.
Here's the growth you experience is that maybe old Dan Harmon would have assumed that I was talking about Community, but you thought I was talking about your relationship. Yeah.
And I was even like, these kids today, they think weddings should be on the internet.
Yeah, so we're going to live stream it. You're going to put it on Ustream? Or,
Honey, did you have a good interview with Chris Hardwick? Yeah, he's more machine than man now. He thinks we're getting married on the internet. In his world, people probably do. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't exist if it doesn't happen on the internet, really. I mean, how can you even prove?
Now get over here and make meaty primate love to me with your non-internet penis.
All right, 15-second Instagram video wedding. Is that better?
Each syllable of the vow is another Instagram with a different filter. The filters are custom filters, each of which espouse a certain vow. Hashtag to love and to cherish.
And your wedding band is the band Filter.
Oh boy!
At the same time, so when is Community?
Community is probably going to be on what used to be called the air, mm-hmm. and is now called a series of tubes.
Yeah,
January, probably the end of January. I've heard the date January 27th bandied about, but there's no reason to think that things won't be actively changing up till that date, you know.
Does it feel the same? Or are you guys going to be able to? Obviously, I would imagine you would have more freedom to do things.
It is like I actually, for the first time, bothered to have that conversation. I never even bothered to ask because, in my mind, I don't care if Yahoo told me that we could say the F word. I don't think it would make me go, "Oh my God, finally, I want to see these characters use the F word." I think there's a tonality and a rhythm to the show that, first and foremost, it doesn't need to be protected. Like, I'm not a fundamentalist community, can't do this and can only do that guy. But I do believe in the sanctity, the familiarity of the product. It was an NBC show. It was done in a certain style, has a certain rhythm. The people that watch the show, they don't, you can't change the shape of a Snickers bar. It's a bad analogy because it makes the people who like Community sound like they're like mindless consumers.
Also, you can just squish a Snickers bar.
you can't change the shape.
Yeah, you literally can. You can just like in your hand. You're strong enough.
Leave it in the sun.
You know, I've never tried. I just have a drink. Chris, are you sure you're doing okay?
Yeah, no, I.
He's squeezing Snickers bars at home.
I'm strong.
Stupid pack with peanuts. You don't satisfy me.
Ow, I got stabbed by a peanut nub. The pointy part.
He loses to the Snickers bar.
You know, you think peanuts are all smooth, but then you forget there's that one pointy part, and it really hurts.
I think eating it changes, like, bite by bite, every time.
Yeah, all right, Spock.
Ha ha ha!
Who invited the nerd?
Actually, Captain. Okay. I'm going to go fuck this alien.
Technically speaking, we all change shape of everything when we consume it. Our amino acids fundamentally alter the composition.
God damn it, beam him into space, please. This is Spock just floating outside the Enterprise.
He's still arguing about the... I'm just making the... I don't understand this reaction to my perfectly valid observation. All right, so anyways, January 27th, probably, maybe. Yes, we can. I heard from them. Technically speaking, if we wanted to have Annie run into the room in the first episode and go, shit, balls, fuck! I think maybe even fuck? I don't even know. Yeah. But like I heard them describe like a hard or a soft R,
sure,
or a hard PG kind of thing, but I don't believe I would be taking advantage of that in any major way, because I'm really, as a fan of the show, I would be very concerned about the show being too different too fast.
Yeah.
So I mean, I want my at least, you know, for the first episode, I want to go, okay, everything else is changing, so let's make sure this thing feels like Community.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that answers your whole question. Yes. Yes, we can, and no, we probably won't.
And I always loved the idea that the pilot that you did with Stiller and Owen and Jack, the motorcycle. Why did it just?
I shouldn't be sitting here waiting for you to.
No,
I was. I'm like, oh, he's almost got it. He's almost got it.
I know it. I know it because I've seen it, but for some reason, my brain just froze.
I was just sort of like watching his mouth and like, no, you can help him. It would be the polite thing to do. It's a weird title.
It's one of those things where it's like, no, I know that. I know it. It's like forgetting a friend of yours his name.
Yeah, I know. Well, listen, I don't know how old you are, but I forgot what's his name's name yesterday. And I remembered it, and now I don't remember it again. I think I mean Ben Folds.
I think we're the same age.
Yeah. I seriously sometimes I forget like just a regular name, like James Spader's name or something.
Yeah.
And I'll go like, I forgot who's the guy, and people are at the table and they're talking, and they're like, I'm going through a private like movie of the week where I'm like, I forgot James Spader's name. I can't say James Spader because I forgot his name. I can ask my friends at the table right now who was the guy in Mannequin, and after they say Andrew McCarthy and I say no, I'll get the information I need. I could also get out my phone, but if I just wait until I reachieve in memory of whatever
James
his name was.
Spader.
It's like, do you think that when you forget something, you force yourself to remember?
Yes,
do you
yes.
think you're repairing your
yes,
brain like,
yes,
a, like
yes.
a bridge?
Absolutely. Like, oh, no, because if I can recall it, that means it's okay.
I mean, God then, knows if I just look it up, it's not going to stop happening.
And then the
that's
rest of
sure.
your friends are talking about global terrorism, and all of a sudden you just smack the table and go, James Spader! And everyone stops and looks at you. Because yeah. you were not engaged in their conversation yeah. at all. What was it? What is it, Kyle?
Heat Vision and Jack.
Heat Vision and Jack. God damn it! Oh fuck! And I've seen it a bunch of times too. But I the idea that you, when we talked about this before, your idea was that you were going to make the worst. You said you were going to make the worst pilot you could possibly think of in terms of like the concept of
yeah.
Something that a network worse in the sense that the network would never go for it.
Yeah, yeah. We said let's make something. We were in a blind deal with ABC at the time, and what we said was to ourselves, let's get out of our deal with ABC. Let's make something that they hate. Let's write something that they hate and turn it in on spec. And Rob said, like, what will they hate? Like, and I said, let's write what we love because we want to get out of this deal. Because why? Because we're going in and we're getting a sense of incompatibility here. Mm-hmm. Like, and nobody's the hero or the villain in the story. Let's just bring it to a head.
Yeah.
Let's write what we really would like to see on TV, and let's not even filter it through any kind of maybe they'll like this, maybe they won't. Let's just actually write the show that would be our favorite television show and we would want to watch 1,000 episodes of. Yeah, that was it. And you spend the rest of your life trying to regain that perfect self-actualized, because it took about a weekend to write that script. It took less than a weekend. And it's like, wow, I figured out how to do it. How come I couldn't ever do it again?
You're in the Heat Vision scene in the Harmontown documentary in theaters October 3rd.
I am.
Yeah, you talk about how you used to find it on VHS, so you'd hunt down a VHS
copy
of that.
I think maybe I raided a storage closet in the Viacom building once and found like a VHS tape of old Ben Stiller show episodes, and he Vision and Jack too. I had it on VHS.
What's funny about that is it doesn't exist anywhere. Like Ben Stiller doesn't even have a copy of it.
I know, it's so funny when you like. I mean, you probably asked me for a copy several times, and I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't know. It's like so weird how we're the people that lose our copies first because we think, ooh, I worked on the show. It's gotta be. There's gotta be another copy around here somewhere. And then it's like you end up 70 years old giving a tour of an apartment to a new tenant who's coming through because now you're just managing a building that you wisely paid for with some of your Rick and Morty money. And it's 2070, and you're because I'm zero now. And you're going, you know, this room's good for an office. You know, if you ever have work to do, I don't know what you do. I'm a writer. Oh, I was a writer. Now I'm your landlord. I used to work on the Heat, Vision, and Jack. You know, I suppose you never heard of that.
So first months and last months?
Those were some times. So, you know, I don't even have a copy of it. Hang on to your VHS tape, young man, where you make a pilot.
What is a VHS tape? So it's $15,000 a month for this 1,000-square-foot apartment? It's way in the future.
Yeah. That's the one thing we can count on is just the dollars. It's like people are rolling around wheelbarrows full of cash.
Well, that's why I was like, I always think of the scene in Running Man where she, I guess it's Maria Conchita Alonso, goes to the soft drink. I think it's Running Man, and it's like $6 for a soft drink. And that was so funny when that movie came out. Right. Like, oh, in the future, everything's going to be like, well,
they nailed it.
Yeah, I was at the airport. I bought a bottle of fucking water. It was like $4.50.
Yeah, like, they really. Water. I still find myself saying it's really embarrassing when I'm talking to a young person, which is all the time as I get older. And I go, and they go like, I'll just characterize something as costing a certain amount. That's not the point. Like they'll go, yeah, well, they did a good job. I mean, they were really nice people. And I'll say, yeah, that and 50 cents will get you a candy bar. And then I'm waiting for the impact of that wry observation, but they're like, it will? Where in Korea? Like, shelter somewhere?
I was just assuming that idea had an inherent value of 50 cents or a dollar, which would get you to like $1.50 or $2 if you had additional...
In your analogy, I, for some reason, already have a fixed amount of money.
Well, maybe I just see ideas as commodities, okay? So that's your failing. I think ideas are worth money. And
that's
that we
just
should
my
be able to,
2,000 cents.
I think we should be able to buy candy with stories.
In a perfect world.
So go back to your fucking rock concerts or whatever you kids do now. So October 3rd, Harmontown.
Yeah.
In theaters. In
theaters everywhere.
And on the internet. All iTunes.
At the same time?
All everywhere.
Nice. Well, good luck with the next season. And good luck with the... It sounds like you're getting a lot of good stuff out of couples therapy.
It's very exciting to find out that it can also be like Minecraft.
Yes. Well, as long as you know that that's how your brain absorbs information.
Aaron was a little offended by it at first, but then the therapist was like, no, this is, you want this. She's like, so it's like a video game that telling me what I need to hear. It's like, this is the problem. You wanting someone to feel things.
All I'm trying to do, Aaron, is give Dan a diamond pickaxe.
But do you find yourself in couples therapy, therapy trying to be like the therapist like you more? Like
I won the first session. My therapist is an amazing like Kabbalah lesbian who is married to a woman apparently like Aaron. So as these facts just slowly came out, I was like, when I walked in, I was like, oh no, she looks like Velma from Scooby Doo. I'm fucked. like this is not my archetype. This is not my audience. Yeah. And then it just like over time, I was like, she's siding with me way too much. And then she full blown just kind of goes like, look, I get what Dan's saying personally more because my wife is kind of more like Aaron. And I'm like, holy cow, I'm winning couples therapy and I have a lesbian friend. This is amazing. But seriously, she's great. She's really awesome. And I don't know. It's not we got punished immediately for trying to win. Like, we both learned that right away. And that's like, that's what you think. Like, I wasn't going forever because it's like, oh shit, it's the principal's office. If you're a guy, couples therapy is like, what's going to happen other than you being presented with an emotional invoice? You owe me this. You have to change this. You have to do this less. It's really not like that. It's like, it's actually, it will free up more of your time. I'm assuming all couples therapists are the exact same.
I've gone to couples therapy in a previous relationship, and I always remember kind of going in feeling like, you know, like, oh, we're in a lot of trouble, and then kind of leave feeling like, oh yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, we were actually communicating and actually talking about our thing. Like, we had to have another person aim it back at us and to get us to communicate.
It didn't really occur to me until I started feeling the benefits in that room. It was right under my nose. It's like, oh yeah, you know what? If you're in a relationship and there's only one person you can talk to about what's going on in your relationship, and it's probably the wrong person, given that you're probably pissed off about something.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's like you could, with the best intentions, like, create a situation where you're just drifting apart. Because, like, why would you – if you're a great boyfriend, why would you want to lay a bunch of this shit on your girlfriend's doorstep? But at the same time, you wouldn't want to talk behind her back about it either, because that's also, like, a weird – like, why are you talking to another person? But so talking to a qualified professional who you're paying money, who doesn't, like, you know, is never going to see you again. It's like – it's the doy. Like,
well, it's almost – you know, I think we also – there could be this kind of thing where a lot of times you're standing nose to nose with a mirror.
Yeah.
And so all you see is yourself.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, this is the whole picture.
Yeah.
And then someone just like grabs you and just like jerks you back. And then you look and you get back.
You're
and
right.
Oh, there's all this other stuff in here.
Yeah.
And I'm a lot smaller in this landscape than I thought I was, because I just needed to take a few steps back.
That's it. That's exactly
good.
It.
All right. It's good to see you, man. Thanks
good
for coming
to see
in.
You. You're such a friendly, positive influence on my life. You're compassionate and you care about your actions toward me, and you care about my drinking, and you have a little office here with a Chewbacca iPad mini cover. And there's weird pictures of gagged children in a shoebox.
Now, listen, it's not a shoebox.
There's no shoe that would ever fit in here.
No,
this is
no.
A treasure
it's
chest.
A vintage cigar box that I got on Etsy.
Now leaving Nerdist.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.